Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to Text Message, the UK-focused technology podcast with me, Nate Langson.
And me, Ian Morris.
Thank you to patrons, including Roger Martin, Neil Horton, Jeff Skipper, Richard Bruce, KV, Roz Hanlon, Robert Wilson, Liam Daly, David Sheard, many others who are supporting us directly. You can join them and get access to our weekly sister show, Extra Message, by going to patreon.com/UK Tech. We've got a whole bunch of people in the live chat room as well, including Al Struthers, John Evans, Nick Gassman, Pangolin Sandwich, Richard Taylor, and it's great to have you with us. Ian, when was the last time we podcasted together? Was it quite a few weeks ago?
No, I don't think it was that long, was it? Didn't we do one like before you... It was last week, wasn't it? The week before last.
Week before last, yeah, because I was in Scotland last weekend.
Yes, and how was it?
It was... Well, I was helping Andy move house.
And how was that?
It was it was a story littered with failings of the logistics system, of Andy crashing a car into the front of his old house at midnight when we were packing up, of sofas arriving in Edinburgh and not being able to fit up the new spiral staircase.
Eek.
You know, just a lot of disaster taking place after disaster. But we moved him in. He was well, he was fine, but the time to do a podcast as I'd planned just never manifested itself, unfortunately. So we're back this week and looking forward to talking about a whole array of topics. But I want to start with something that I don't do very often, and certainly not at the top of the show, which is to talk about something that I've been working on at Bloomberg this week. And it relates to the coronavirus that at the time of recording has claimed more than 300 lives. And I was working on covering the tech side of the epidemic and the impact to technology companies this week at work. And I decided to look into how some of these firms are responding specific to the contagion. And particularly, I was very curious at people in the sharing economy, in the gig economy, and Airbnb in particular, because it has hundreds of listings out in Wuhan in China, where this virus is said to have originated. And to my surprise, certainly, when I searched for places to stay in Wuhan this week, and bear in mind I was doing this from London at my desk at Bloomberg in Bank, there was no mention of the epidemic anywhere in the search results for properties. I was not being shown any warning or anything that may suggest, hey, you might not be able to get into China, or hey, if you do, you might potentially contract a very fatal and deadly and problematic illness. So I thought, well, let's see how far this goes. I tried to book one of these properties. I was even offered a discount because it was Lunar New Year. Several properties were marked as rare finds because they are usually booked. And part of me thought, well, NS Sherlock, that doesn't come as a huge shock. And the booking went through fine. Money left my account. I got a confirmation in my email. And I thought this was pretty strange. For example, if you go to the website of Hilton Hotels, the listings for the hotels they have in Wuhan, in the area, are decorated with warnings and notifications and alerts and things that bookings are on hold until at least mid-February. And in some instances, things were like, oh, only certain floors are accessible, and obviously swimming pool is out of action and all this kind of stuff. And so it just, to me, it looked a little bit like Airbnb was ignoring the issue for somebody who is sitting here in the UK, and so I thought, presumably, anywhere else in the world. So I started writing this story, and Airbnb initially gave me a comment that it was sending messages to people in China, to hosts. And I managed to get hold of some of those emails that it had sent to hosts, and I translated them. And they were advising that guests, or rather, they were advising hosts to help guests rebook their travel arrangements, or at the very least, make sure that the properties they were leasing out were being well ventilated and disinfected. But I still thought it was pretty weird that A, bookings were still being accepted by these hosts, and B, worse that I could sit here in London and book and pay for a holiday in Wuhan without even being told I might at best not be allowed in and at worst die. So after this booking went through it, I was sitting there with all this thinking, okay, there's probably a story in this, but I'm not quite sure what the angle is other than, hey, I can book a thing in Wuhan. I then got a message from the person whose Airbnb I had booked with, in Chinese, naturally. So we ended up chatting via Google Translate, and I explained I was a journalist. I explained why I'd booked and so on and so forth. And they were happy chatting. And they said that they were staying open for business, not so people in London could book and try and have a place to stay in Wuhan, but because there are so many people currently stranded in Wuhan who have been cut off from the ability to leave the city because of the lockdown due to the virus, that it was in their interests and the interests of other Airbnb hosts to stay open and accept bookings. And essentially, they thought they could help. Now, Airbnb wasn't super happy. Sorry, go in and jump in.
No, I was going to say that actually does explain it quite nicely and makes perfect sense in some ways.
It does, and if that was the whole of the story, then I would say, well, that is quite interesting. But focusing on the European side of a global story like this, that alone wasn't going to be a story enough for me. And I just couldn't get over the fact that I could go through this entire booking process, have my money taken, have all these arrangements set up. Even the following day got a reminder that said something like, you know, it's only 24 hours until your trip to Wuhan. And I thought, well, it's a good job it isn't. And even in that message again, still, and this was on Friday, still no mention of anything, you know, not even so much as a single line FYI and a link to the WHO website or something. And Airbnb wasn't super happy with the story, I don't think. But my reason for writing it wasn't to highlight that it was bad that properties could be booked. You know, it's totally believable that I might have, say, a relative in Wuhan and I was booking a place for them. The problem, as I saw it, is that, you know, this is a global company with a global responsibility, and that I could sit in London and browse and book without so much as a heads up. And I was looking at what some other companies have done. You know, Google had partnered with the World Health Organization to flag the latest information about the coronavirus if you search for it. Facebook has said that it's monitoring and taking down misinformation posts to help control potential panic.
Well, that's a first.
Well, I mean, a lot of the attention for Facebook has always been on disinformation. You know, it's been deliberate attempts to skew public opinion or sensibilities. Misinformation is, you know, it's not intentional. It's almost a byproduct of fear rather than any kind of deliberate malice. And it's people saying, oh, I've heard this or I've heard that. And there's been some interesting sort of moral debates about whether temporary racism against Chinese people is justified. And there are some people saying, well, I'm afraid to go near somebody who appears to me to be of Chinese origin. And it's like, well, you could sort of understand a fragment of the thinking, but at the same time, it's like, that's not really the way that we want to be living. Certainly, it's not the way I would like to live. So there's a lot of conversations around that. And I think that's a lot of what Facebook's trying to do. And we could debate all day, as you say, as to whether those responses are sufficient or effective or unique or whatever. But the fact is they're doing something. And to me, I just felt Airbnb wasn't doing enough. So again, you know, I was telling Airbnb was very aware that I was doing this piece. And shortly before the story went out, they did give me a quote. And I'm going to read it out just because we've bashed on them a little bit so far, which is, Airbnb is closely monitoring official news and guidance about the novel coronavirus outbreak in order to support our community of hosts, guests, and employees in China and around the world. We are prioritizing their safety and well-being. In accordance with guidance and recommendations from the World Health Organization, the Chinese government, and other local and health authorities, we have activated our extenuating circumstances policy to offer impacted hosts and guests the option of cancellation of the reservations without charges. As the situation evolves, we will be continuously evaluating and updating this policy in line with official guidance. So a lot of that relates to refunds, really. And I felt it was a little bit vague as well, you know, prioritizing the safety and well-being. I thought, well, you're a giant company preparing to go public on, you know, on the stock market in some form. Could you not really justify quickly putting a line like all these other websites and companies have done to say, heads up, deadly virus? Anyway, This is where things get a little bit more interesting, because that was all sort of towards the end of Friday. Over the weekend, I did another search for a place to stay in Wuhan from my iPad, from my app, exactly the same, still in London, and I saw something new. There was a big banner above the search results for these properties saying, in bold letters, coronavirus outbreak. The World Health Organization declared a global health emergency for the coronavirus outbreak. Please review official travel advisories and take necessary precautions. Read more in the Help Center. Now, I'm not arrogant enough to say that my story directly led to that appearing.
Well, it probably did, though, didn't it? Did anyone else write about it?
No.
Well, there you go, then. It almost certainly was you.
But the fact of the matter is that it's good that it's been done, and I'm going to look into this and the effectiveness and how widely it, you know, it is propagated, if you like, around the site and the app on Monday and Tuesday. But it's one of these things where it just feels like the kind of thing that a more experienced company, or if someone who's been running something like this or had been running the business, say, when the SARS outbreak took place, you know, which is before Airbnb existed, whether this would have been done faster or in a better or more wholesome way, if you like, than 300 people dying before it even gets a reference on the website like this. So
yeah.
I think that I'm glad Airbnb has done this. And I think it's good that this was the ultimate result. But it was just a very interesting reporting journey for me for this week, and also allowed us to talk a little bit about a massive global news event on this podcast.
Yes, and but I will say this. I don't necessarily think it's Airbnb's responsibility to tell people where they can and can't go. Like you said, there are enough reasons to use Airbnb that, you know, that don't just revolve around tourism. The government, obviously, has the key responsibility. Your airline, when you book with them, if you've got a flight booked, say you booked last year, and obviously this wasn't happening then, you know that they would have a responsibility to tell you, just in case you didn't know and hadn't been paying attention to the news somehow. You know, by the way, just to let you know, there's a chance you'll get a pretty bad lung infection if you go to China at the moment. Well, I mean, not that it's a big chance. But you know, but for Airbnb, I mean, I don't think there's any harm in them having information on the site that explains this. I just don't think it's their primary responsibility. I mean, that's what the FCO's travel advice pages are for, which people would obviously be well advised to check before they go somewhere.
This is all perfectly fair. And the reality is that you could book an Airbnb and you would still have to book a flight. You would still have to clear customs. You would almost certainly never get in. And I get that. But there is a responsibility, I think, on any company that is allowing you to spend money to potentially go to a place where you have an illness. And let's be honest, how hard is it to code a short message into a website?
Not at all. Not in the slightest. There is another unintended consequence of this, potentially, in that I noticed the Americans have now said that foreign nationals who have visited China will not be allowed to go into America. So this, if you had gone to China, say if your trip wasn't fictional and for the purposes of the story, and then you had a business trip planned for America, you might be struggling to achieve that. So there are other aspects to this that might make it more of an issue.
And for what it's worth, I think it's only fair to say as well, we're recording this on the afternoon of Sunday. So by the time this goes out, or by the time you listen to it, all of this may have changed. So do look up the latest information before planning or changing any plans. I'm sure anyone would do anyway. And a couple of things have kind of come up in the chat room while we've been talking about this live. John says that he'd seen friends on Twitter who've been having grief for being Asian, such as people moving away from them on trains.
Yes.
I've not seen that yet myself. Al Struthers asked an interesting question, I think, of you, Ian. Why would the airline have more of a responsibility than the accommodation? And I think he's referring to making you aware of potential health risks.
Yeah, I saw this, and I mean, I think it's a fair point. I'm not necessarily suggesting that they do. The one thing you will notice when you have a flight booked with an airline is you will almost certainly receive status updates via text message. They communicate a lot. I have this problem where, you know, my work phone has belonged to someone else before, and I get a lot of status updates about flights and stuff that I'm not booked on. And I just feel like with that, maybe it's slightly easier for them to tell you. I don't know. I guess it isn't any different, really. I think it's good that they do it. I think it's good that Airbnb do it. But I, you know, I just feel like with airlines, it's just, it just seems like more of the first step.
Any opinions anybody has on this topic or any other tech angles that you've heard around the virus, do let us know. hello@uktechshow.com. Stay safe. And if anyone is in an affected area, obviously, we wish you the very best.
You're used to hearing the smooth, velvet sound of Nate's voice drizzled over your ears like a warm eardrum syrup, topped off with the freshly squeezed citrus tang of an Ian Morris opinion. Supporters of the show at patreon.com/UKTech enjoy second helpings every week. So pull up a chair, find your nearest spoon, and tuck into a sumptuous extra helping with no commitment. If you have any allergies, please inform a waiter.
Following Britain's departure from the EU, which, no, we're not going into today, our government has updated its website to advise on some stuff that's up for change. It included notice that free mobile roaming may now end. We've enjoyed for a couple of years, I think, Ian, the ability to travel across Europe and not have to worry about roaming fees for calls and data. Certainly, those on the continent have also enjoyed the same here in Britain, but there's now a big question mark over it after the government published a document on its new website. And I'm going to read it out in full in the name of transparency. It says this: from the 1st of January 2021, the guarantee of free mobile roaming throughout the EU, Iceland, Liechtenstein, and Norway will end. Check with your phone operator to find out about any roaming charges you might get from the 1st of January 2021. A new law means you're protected from getting mobile data charges above £45 without you knowing. Once you reach £45, you'll need to opt in to spend more so that you can continue using the internet while you're abroad. Your phone operator will tell you how you can do this. Now, we'll include a link to that statement and other notifications the government has published to its website this week at uktechshow.com. Now, what's important to remember here is that whether or not the likes of Vodafone, 3, O2 and EE want to protect you, their customers, from bill shock, it's not entirely up to them. They may very well want to not suffer the bad PR of having to rescind these roaming promotions they've got, but there may come a point where they have no choice, because mobile operators in Europe can charge them for what you're doing on their networks. And a lot of the time, that cost is being passed on to you. That's how it worked. The law didn't stop people being billed. It stopped the networks billing each other in large part. So the mobile operators may at some point pass that cost back onto you. And if you remember, Ian, it used to cost, I certainly remember at one point when I was on O2 a few years ago, it cost £3 per megabyte to use data in Germany. And it was £6 a megabyte to use that in the US, which I appreciate is outside of the jurisdiction of the European Union.
Well, yeah.
You know, but that's where we were heading. And so there are possible outcomes. One, and certainly I hope this is what happens, is that the networks will just agree to carry on as they are now in exchange for our networks in Britain charging their customers no more when they're roaming over here. But I'm just not confident that that will necessarily take place, since it took Europe-wide legislation to be enacted over several years gradually to force them to change in the first place. And we have no widespread independent deals with non-European countries' networks, hence still being charged an arm and a leg for using data out of bundle, say, in the US or in Canada. I mean, do you think, is that a fair assumption?
I don't know. I'm so confused by the whole thing, because, as you said, the rule is clear. The EU prohibits these operators from charging each other across boundaries. The fact is that we already have that in place. It wouldn't be very difficult for the UK to say, well, we'd like to carry on with it. Would you be okay with that, European operators? Then the European operators will think, well, a lot of our customers go to the UK, so it would be nice if we didn't have to pay them for that access. And presumably we could charge what we wanted because we're not in the EU anymore. So it could be prohibitively expensive. I mean, that isn't in anyone's interest. So my gut tells me that they will hang on to this free data across Europe for as long as possible.
I think you're right. And the chat room is asking a couple of interesting questions while we're talking. Al asked if, or rather he said that he saw a few networks had come out saying they won't reintroduce them anyway, which, as he points out, is indeed cool, and hopefully that will stay the same. But that doesn't get around the problem that they can't guarantee networks overseas will stop charging them, and or rather won't restart charging them and force the local network's hands. But hopefully it won't come to that. And Nick asks an interesting question of, isn't it going to be tied up in any given trade agreement?
Well, I was going to say this because obviously we actually don't know yet what the trade agreement will be with the EU. And this was part of the whole thing has changed so much over the last 3 years. It makes it very difficult to keep track of. I mean, part of the idea was that we would have a relatively soft Brexit and that we would hang on to both. We would keep parity with the EU. Now, the government has recently said that that is not actually going to happen at all, and that British companies will not be required to maintain European standards. Now, of course, again, we all know that any company in this country will be very, very keen to keep hold of their EU sales, and therefore they are going to stick to the EU rules for pretty much everything. I can't think of examples where that wouldn't happen. But again, we thought we might come out in a more soft way. At the moment, it looks like we're going to come out in the hardest way imaginable.
I wouldn't say that is necessarily true, in that we, you know, a deal was agreed. Obviously the deal has to be implemented, but there are positive signs in there that it couldn't be terrible from a tech perspective. For example, data protection and data sharing cross-border is certainly one of the most important things. I'd argue more important than roaming charges, because it will affect companies on a much more fundamental level, which is, how do you guarantee that companies that rely on data and personal information being transferred in and out of the EU, how that has to be guaranteed that it can continue unrestricted? Otherwise, businesses that rely on that are going to have a massive, enormous problem. And that's only going to happen. It's only going to be agreed if Europe agrees that the UK has implemented the minimum required sort of safety precautions on data protection. So as long as we get our data protection in order in a way that the EU likes, then the flow of data can continue. And then it may not be that hard a Brexit related to data and and things as it could otherwise be. But as you say, we still don't know a great deal of this yet. And the reason that we're talking about it today isn't because we want to add fear, uncertainty and doubt into the Brexit equation. That's not why we're here, and it's not why we're talking about Brexit itself. What's happened has happened, and we're not a political podcast, really. The reason to talk about it is because the government added a big fat paragraph of text on their website saying, hey, heads up, This is what we're thinking could happen, and here's how much it's going to cost you under a new proposed law. So that's the thing to be aware of. I think we've got. I hate the term "time will tell." I think if you end a story on "time will tell" or "we'll have to wait and see," then you've fundamentally failed at storytelling. But there's not much else that we can do here at this point, because there is so much that we don't know.
Not really. And if you look at the rest of the world, you will not get included data in most countries. So you could argue that that's the way it would go.
It could be good news for public Wi-Fi companies, companies like the cloud and these universal SIM providers that will sell you a SIM with data you can use worldwide.
And this is true. And also, we're much less reliant on calls and texts than we ever were before. I mean, I remember, some of my trips to Europe in the bad old days before this law came in the first place, and the US would have racked up charges on text messages. Of course, WhatsApp makes that completely unnecessary, and Wi-Fi publicly is generally pretty good in most places now. I mean, you might spend time outside of a Wi-Fi network occasionally, but it's never been easier to find public Wi-Fi. So I guess it might not be a huge problem, but again, it's just sad. You'd hope it'd go the other way. And it's not just about the EU. It's a a global thing. You know, there should be a better arrangement with all these providers, whereby you can roam for a much more affordable cost. It's just a shakedown, isn't it? And it's sad.
Mm. And I remember I was asked a question a couple of years ago. Someone said, "Well, why do if I'm on say Vodafone and I roam onto Vodafone Germany, why am I incurring charges?" And the sad fact is that they're run as separate businesses.
Yeah, you know, of course.
So they still have to bill each other.
Ultimately, these service providers, they're going to want to make money. And this is another way for them to do that. So you could be sceptical about it and go, actually, it's not in the UK network's interest to allow us to use our phones in Europe without charging us for it. So they'll bring it back in. I don't know. I think, like you said, no one will want to be the first. But when one does it, there's a very big chance that all or most will do the same. You might get someone like Three who will say, we're not going to do it, because they had European roaming for free before the EU rules came in anyway, didn't they? Because they did some deals, and they also happened to own a few other networks across Europe, which worked out quite well for them. But then, like you said,
Three has a part of some of its plans where the US is included.
Oh yeah,
in roaming, which is good.
It's one of the best things about Three is that US roaming thing, because it's great. You're often throttled quite a lot, but it's still workable for things like email and stuff like that. I've used it and been frustrated by it at the same time as thinking, actually, this is not bad for a free service.
It's worth reminding people, I think, that the proposed rule change that we were talking about on the government's website, it does only apply, or does only state that it applies to mobile data charges. It's not even to do with calls and texts. It is only specifically relating to data. It says, protected from getting mobile data charges above £45 without you knowing, relating to the new law. And once you reach £45, you need to opt in to spend more than that so you can continue using the internet while you're abroad.
Yeah, it might just be someone didn't understand what they were writing, frankly.
I don't know. I mean, I can disagree really? With a lot. But yeah, I kind of find that a lot of the way that the government writes stuff on its website, I find it to be pretty clear. But who knows? Sure. Who knows, Ian? That's the question.
Yeah, well, exactly.
If you are in the UK or in the European Union and would like to talk to us about this, we do not discriminate against whatever territory you're based in.
And you won't be charged extra for sending an email from Europe.
Certainly not. You can do so. hello@uktechshow.com. The BBC reported this week that BT will charge new customers up to £50 if they do not send their router back at the end of their contract. This is in an effort to reduce waste. Since December, BT's contracts have stated that the company retains ownership of the Wi-Fi routers and TV set-top boxes that it sends to customers, the BBC wrote. The company also told the Financial Times that it would quote-unquote refurbish the returned equipment so that it could be reused. Virgin Media already operates a similar policy. Now, BT told the BBC that the change would eventually apply to its EE and PlusNet subsidiaries as well, and it will charge customers between about 43 and 50 quid if they want to keep the router, depending on the model. You can also get the Uview TV set-top box from BT, and that will cost between about 60 and £115, depending on the model. And it's not reduced its monthly subscription charges as a result of the change, but did say that customers wouldn't be charged up front for the router or TV box. So this is only if you are at the end of a contract, and it is if you don't send it back. You know, you're contributing potentially to waste there, so BT states. The BBC also wrote that customers will be sent a padded envelope to return their router to BT, and also will be able to drop off equipment at their stores on the high street. So I think this is tied in quite broadly to a number of topics that we've discussed on the podcast over recent months, which is the idea of how much responsibility do these companies have on keeping landfill as small as possible.
Well, I would say they have some, but I don't think this is anything to do with keeping stuff out of landfill. Is that unpleasantly skeptical of me, do you think?
No. I mean, all of these things will have an element of PR value.
Well, I feel like it's them trying to make some money, if you will.
Well, here you go. So Richard Taylor in the chat room says, I've always gotten rid of any BT routers in favour of a Netgear or Firebox, which is good, right? He says, on the plus side, it's better than just throwing them in the recycling bin.
Okay, so here's the problem, right? My understanding is, from the BBC News story says that BT routers only work on BT. So anyone leaving BT will have absolutely no reason to keep that router. It doesn't make any sense. So that, you know, from that perspective, yes, they should probably want to return it. They're not. They are going to get no value out of it if they return.
Can you not flash the firmware?
I mean, you might be able to, but no one is ever going to do that. I mean, do you remember the days of B?
I do, yeah. B Unlimited.
Yeah, so you could do some awesome things with B. Like, you know, you could tweak your firmware and you could adjust the noise floor, you know, allowances, so you could get much faster broadband if your line was quite clean. So that was great. But those days are long gone. And BT says in its statement to the BBC, the reason it locks its routers to its own network is that so that it can better administer them and provide security updates. Now, I personally think that's nonsense. There is absolutely nothing to stop them from being unlocked from other networks and you still being able to flash them. It's just a nonsense. They're connected directly to your network. It's horse manure is what it is. So first thing is, those routers have no value. They're not actually stopping anyone from... If you paid that fee, you'd probably still end up chucking it away because it's not going to be any good to you. So what you're going to do is you're going to pay BT maybe 60 or 50 quid, whatever, and then you're going to go, actually, I can't use this anyway. My new ISP has sent me a new piece of hardware. It's useless to me. I think most people will probably return them, but what you've got to remember is that people are lazy. I've done this myself in not this quite way. But they won't return them because they'll be like, oh, it's a hassle. I can't be bothered. And they'll just pay the money because it's easier, which is stupid, but we all do it.
I think you might be surprised how many people won't want to pay £50.
No, I mean, that's fine. Router. But my point is that this isn't actually really going. I don't think it's going to solve a huge problem. I mean, sure, if BT are going to refurbish them and then reuse them, fine. But also you've got to remember that these routers go out of use quite quickly. If you were to, I would say within the standard contract period of BT, they would release a new kind of router. And if you're a new subscriber to BT, you're not going to want, and they are not going to send you an old router. So what happens to them? They might strip them down properly. They might recycle them properly. Great. No, I'm sure that's not dissimilar to what you would do if you took it to a proper recycling facility or, you know, wherever. So I from the landfill point of view, I'm not really buying it, frankly. I think it's a slight confusion in that should they not perhaps charge you for the hardware up front rather than charge you at the end? So
I think that's,
refund that money to you at the end if you decided you wanted to return it.
I think that would probably prevent a few people signing up.
Ah, well, there you go then. So it's not actually got anything to do with what they say it's to do with. It's probably a little bit about the fact that they do spend money building these things. I'm sure they don't cost a huge amount of money. They're probably $10 products, if that. So they're probably losing a little bit of money on them. As you said, they don't factor it into the rental. Which is different to Virgin, because when you go to Virgin, you know that you don't own the equipment. It's made, I say it's made quite clear to you. I don't know if it actually is, but it is a rental. It isn't, you don't own the hardware. Again, it is completely useless to you once you've finished with your Virgin service anyway. So there's no reason not to return it. But again, you know, sometimes you might just not be bothered, whatever. So I think that there needs to be a radical change in messaging. I'm sure they will do this. They probably need to have something on the website saying, just a note, if you don't return this at the end of your contract period and you don't carry on with this, you will be charged. I'm sure that will happen. But like you say, it would be more honest to charge people at the front of their contract and then to refund that money at the end. A deposit,
I think we're in a very good position to do something with our audience that we don't ordinarily do. We normally invite you to write in if you have an opinion. We don't often ask you to write in and tell us an opinion, but I think this is an exception. I would love to get some emails from as many people as possible, no matter where you're based, and particularly if you're not based in the UK, it's probably very relevant. What do you do with your old routers? you know, what do you do with them? I mean, hello@uktechshow.com or send them to us on Twitter @textmessagepod. You know, what have you historically done? Have you changed? What is the standard? Like, do you know what your company offers? Do you have any knowledge of what kind of level of ownership you have over this hardware? I have to say, I've certainly got two or three old routers stashed in boxes or just thrown away.
Yeah.
Certainly, I've got that. And that's not because I don't care about the environment. It's just, you're right, I've never really known what to do with those things. So I just keep them. Probably need to get to a point, and it may take legislation to get here, where routers, you know, the fundamental piece of technology that is, that connects the line that comes into your house, whatever line that is, to a box that spreads it around your house, needs to be as flexible as mobile phones are now. You know, we have some very good laws, very liberal laws now, about the rules on phone locking, on unlocking, on what do you do with the hardware after a contract period has expired. And I think it'll probably follow suit that routers now are so important to people. People are thinking more about mesh networks and network strength in different rooms and all this kind of stuff, and how many devices can they have running at once, that people are starting to care about the hardware. The interfaces are getting better when you log in to try and fix them. The setup process has got easier with the, you know, like the one push button, was it WPS button or something, to do like one click setup for devices. Yeah. Like it's getting there, but we probably need to go even further. And certainly interoperability between network providers, to me at least now, feels like a no-brainer. Like, to have it locked to a network is just, that is going to contribute more to waste than anything else. Let's move into some feedback. We had a quite a good response, Ian, to your conversation.
Yes.
Well, and mine, about the headphones. We had loads of people writing in. I picked a quote from Raphael, who says, "Hi guys, it happens that I own and used Bowers & Wilkins headphones for nearly 10 years now, and what I really like about them is they last forever. Nearly every part can be replaced. I recently replaced my P5s for a similar model because I wanted the noise cancellation, and I'm very happy with it." That's a good point. When you buy a nice high-end pair of headphones, you can usually get them replaced and fixed pretty quickly.
Well, that is apart from my one example of B&W headphones, which is, I mean, it is probably more down to the fact that I haven't necessarily treated them in the way they should have been treated. I've folded them up and put them in my bag and carried them around with other stuff, and it's broken the little arm that connects the headphone to the band. So really, that's not B&W's fault. Perhaps there's a slight weakness in the design.
Well, we had another message from Charlotte, who one of our patrons, who says, "I have a question. I have a friend who used to buy Bose noise-cancelling sleep buds, which helped her with her tinnitus, but they're being discontinued. Do you guys know of any good alternatives?" So this is a question I would put out to the wider community for anyone using headphones or earphones to sleep in that can help with tinnitus. Do please write in and let us know. hello@uktechshow.com. We'll read out and or pass on the advice to Charlotte to dispense to her friend. The only example I have off the top of my head is that I really have been very, very impressed with the noise cancelling of Apple's AirPod Pros.
Yeah.
We did an extra message about them, and I know I've hated on the basic AirPods for very, very good reason. But the AirPod Pros, the noise cancelling is really very, very good. Very, very good.
The problem is they're very expensive, aren't they?
They are expensive, but we're talking about someone wanting to replace some Bose noise cancelling headphones, and Bose headphones tend not to be particularly cheap. So,
well, no, that's true. And the Sony ones, how much are the Sony ones, do you know?
I don't know off the top of my head.
I think they're probably a similar price. Nick in the chat asks if tinnitus is internal, how do headphones help? That's a good question, Nick, and I have spent some time thinking about this because I suffer also with tinnitus. It's the same with hearing aids. When you have hearing aids in, it defeats the tinnitus. No one really knows what tinnitus is. I've read once that it was your brain filling in the gap. So as you get older and you lose a bit of your hearing, because everyone does in something, apparently, it might be your brain filling in that gap that it can no longer hear any sound in with something else. But apparently, I mean, you'll notice it if you have tinnitus. If you're in a room that's vaguely noisy, you can't hear it. I can't hear it now because that's not true. I can because I'm thinking about it. But if you have sound coming in, it can help. And obviously everyone hears it differently as well. It's a very unpleasant, I don't want to call it an illness, condition perhaps. It can drive some people mad, literally mad. It's that bad, and it stops people from sleeping and is horrible.
I get it on and off, but mine isn't permanent like a lot of people have it. Although now we're talking about it, I can hear it very, very clearly.
Yeah, it's that's the problem with it. As soon as you start thinking about it, it's much more obvious. That's why I think it's never bothered me. I've got used to ignoring it, and it is frustrating. And it makes you think your hearing's not great, but it's not really related to that. It you know, you can still hear okay with it. It's just this constant sort of noise that fills in gaps when there's nothing else going on. But by the way, last year when I was at CES, I spoke to Cochlear, who are the people who make the implants. So that bypasses the hairs that do the sound pickup in your ear and feeds the sound directly into your brain somehow. I don't know. It's very, very confusing. They said a couple of interesting things. First of all, they said probably only about 5% of people who could benefit from a cochlear implant have one. So because they're quite expensive, obviously, and it is a mild surgical procedure. It's not particularly bad, I don't think. It takes about 90 minutes, they told me.
If anybody has some suggestions for this, Charlotte was asking specifically about replacements for Bose noise-cancelling buds to sleep in to help with tinnitus. But I'm sure any good suggestions of ways that people deal with tinnitus using technology and headphones specifically would be very welcome. So do let us know your stories and suggestions if you have them. hello@uktechshow.com. We didn't have a promo from Tom this week for Daily Tech News Show, partly probably because we haven't done a show for a week and maybe he thought he didn't need to send one. But if you do want to listen to some wider technology news, then obviously dailytechnewsshow.com is the place to go. And thank you to our patrons for supporting us and getting our ad-free versions, our live show, and everything else. So thank you to you all. Ian, it's been a pleasure.
It has, hasn't it? It's been an enjoyable way to spend an hour and 20 minutes.
It has, yes. Well, it depends which version of the show you're listening to.
Well,
but certainly
little Patreon bumper there, you know. Have a listen, have a subscribe.
Yeah. Well, in the Patreon version this week, we talked extensively about USB-C and the alternatives to USB-C and the standards that Europe is trying to force potentially on Apple and various other things. So yeah, there's a lot more in the Patreon version of the show if you would like to check that out. That's it, patreon.com/UKTech. Cheerio, everybody.
Ta-ra!
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.